This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Andres Gomez Emelson. He's an advocate of transhumanism. Andres, it's great talking to you.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host Francis Nelly.
Hi guys, it's nice talking to you.
So Andres, can you tell us a little bit about your background information and how you got interested in transhumanism?
Yeah, for sure. So I guess I would say that I've always been interested in figuring out the nature of reality. And so for the first part of my life, I was extremely into mathematics. I thought like that was kind of like the key to understanding everything. I mean, I still think it's really important, but not the only thing you actually need. Then I think like at about 16, I actually started to be much more interested in consciousness. And kind of like exploring philosophy of mind, philosophy of personal identity. And I also got like really interested in kind of like the nature of happiness as such. I didn't really actually like make the connection until later that actually transhumanism is really, really up my alley. It took me to kind of like read David Pierce and Elias Yudkowsky, maybe like in when I was like 19 or 20 or so. And then I became a kind of like a huge fan and an advocate because I saw kind of like how there was a huge overlap that transhumanism in a sense was systematizing the kind of ethics that I already had, except that it was kind of like pushing the boundary even further. I really like David Pierce's kind of framing of transhumanism, which is the one that I tend to use the most, which is kind of it has like three main objectives, the so-called three S's of transhumanism, which is super happiness, super intelligence, and super longevity. And the three of them are really, really compelling, I think. The one that I end up working the most on, and most of my projects are based on, is super happiness. And I can talk more about that. But that's kind of my introduction.
What is the background of Qualia Computing, and what is your role with that?
Yeah. So Qualia Computing, it actually started out of my conversations with David Pierce. I think until I was like roughly 21, 22, I would say that I would identify myself with kind of like computational theory of mind. That would be my philosophy of mind and consciousness. I used to read Daniel Dennett and Thomas Metzinger, and that it was kind of like the general framework in which I would analyze minds, to think of them as kind of just the result of computational processes, and that deep down consciousness is nothing but information processing. And I think like that's kind of the standard party line within transhumanism. Most people are kind of like really thinking in terms of how can we program a digital computer to make it intelligent, to make it a general intelligence, to make it have consciousness. And that was definitely how I used to look at things. And from that perspective, I thought that the best I could do to advance the field was to just study artificial intelligence, go into artificial intelligence research and so on. I did end up studying artificial intelligence in college, but then by talking to David Pierce, he actually convinced me out of that particular philosophy of mind. He kind of like emphasized the importance of some of the properties of consciousness that philosophy doesn't really account for, including things such as qualia and the phenomenal binding problem, the actual causal properties of consciousness. And it's because the fact that kind of the computational theory of mind doesn't really address all of those problems adequately that I saw together with David Pierce, there was kind of like this theoretical blind spot that somebody could feel. And that's kind of like the reason why I decided to do to work on Quilly computing as kind of a big project is, okay, if the computational theory of mind is not going to solve all of these problems, how could we actually develop a framework that may have a chance at doing that? And so I started Quilly computing about 4 years ago. I think the actual website is been like 3 years.
Is that officially your main website?
Yeah. Well, yes. I would add that kind of the umbrella organization is the Quilia Research Institute. And that's with a few friends here in the Bay Area that we're looking to eventually make it our full-time research project. But that includes like also this other website called opentheory.net. And yeah, the actual Quilia Research Institute website itself. So really, Quilia Computing is like a facet of this bigger organization.
Can you talk about a peaceful Quilia? It's been described as the Manhattan Project of Consciousness.
Yes, for sure. So what I did with that article was to try to visualize what would a very serious consciousness research project look like if it was kind of like something that a nation state would do at a scale similar to the Manhattan Project to create the atomic bomb. So like instead of like pouring like billions of dollars and the most intelligent minds into trying to create a super weapon, imagine instead that we did the same, but in order to create a state of consciousness that was so wonderful and so peaceful and so loving that it might have the potential to prevent wars in the future. Kind of like, that's why it's kind of peaceful Quilia, the Quilia of ultimate peace. And the overall structure of this research institute would be kind of a modular. I mean, you would have actual psychonauts, people who have been trained with rationality as well as mind navigation tools to be able to explore extremely altered states of consciousness while still continue to be sane and always be able to come back to consensus reality without acquiring weird beliefs as usually happens. Then you would also have a module, a group of researchers that are basically crafting psychophysical experiments. Basically, they're looking at interacting with electrodes with the brain, as well as measuring brain activity in many, many different ways, and crafting precise experiments that will be able to determine which of a variety of theories of consciousness is correct, as well as to be able to measure, for example, the valence or the pleasantness of the states of consciousness. And in addition, you would also have like other modules. Like you would have like a kind of like a chemical biochemical module that is actually creating the biochemical tools to change the states of consciousness. And finally, you would have kind of a fundamental research and theory module that is kind of a combination of philosophers and physicists and psychologists that are actually trying to figure out how to connect the dots from Quilia to physics to computation and back.
So with the way the mind works, is there's different parts of your brain with the chemistry that enables either happiness or different emotions, fear, anger, anxiety. Are you talking about rewiring the brain so people are constantly in bliss?
Yeah, to some extent. I would definitely qualify that. So first, definitely there's areas in the brain that if you activate them, you will have a particular emotion as a response. I mean, obviously you have the pleasure centers and you have also like the fear centers, like the amygdala. And if you directly stimulate those parts, either chemically or electrically, you will have like a very strong emotional response. Now, just because you called a part of the brain a pleasure center or a fear center doesn't mean you actually know why it would cause or trigger those feelings. So the kind of research that we do is actually trying to find a fundamental theory for like, why are the pleasure centers actually producing pleasure? Why are the pain centers producing pain? and so on. I could delve a little bit more into that in a bit, but I would also say that in terms of kind of a rewiring the brain, I don't see it as much as kind of just activating the pleasure centers. I mean, there's like this procedure called deep brain stimulation, where basically you just implant electrodes into pleasure centers of a person. And this is fantastic at eliminating intractable depression. It also helps with Parkinson's disease and many other problems. But it has like some profound side effects. In particular, it tends to really change people's personality in very undesirable ways. It makes
people
very...
You're kind of talking about similar to how a lot of anti-anxiety or anti-depression medication works?
Not quite. Actually, they would work in pretty different ways. Deep brain stimulation, in terms of its overall effects, is the most... It's most analogous to kind of a heavy stimulants like amphetamines and cocaine. It tends to have like a similar effect as those, more than things like anti-anxiety or antidepressants. To kind of like give you an idea of where I'm going towards is that I think like the future of mental health will not be focused on only any given particular kind of well-being, but rather it will be based on enriching all of the different manifold varieties of well-being that we have. I mean, it will be enhancing not only motivation, like deep brain stimulation or amphetamines might do, but it will also enhance relaxation as well as high states of creativity and open-mindedness, like high levels of spirituality or psychedelic states. And it's kind of like the whole point will be to recruit all of these different varieties of bliss so that they can collectively achieve objectives by working together. I mean, one possibility is that you would feel extremely motivated in the morning, then that wears off and you become extremely creative in kind of a psychedelic free-flowing state. And at night, you go into a hyper-relaxation state. And then it kind of like goes in a cycle the next day. And that way you prevent yourself from getting stuck in like local maxima, getting stuck in little things that if you just go for any one of these kinds of bliss alone, tends to happen.
So we kind of addressed the whole issue of people are constantly happy and that leads to kind of boredom and lack of creativity.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, because if you only activate one kind of bliss, you usually find problems. I mean, take, for example, relaxation. I mean, the typical case is people who get hooked on heroin. Like, even if you take aside the problem of addiction and tolerance and the fact that it stops working after a while, even if it actually did work constantly, it really wouldn't improve people's productivity or creativity or the quality of their lives very much. It would just prevent them from being anxious, and they would be couch locked all the time, not doing anything. So, and I don't think like that would be very desirable. Rather, the idea would be to be able to cycle between different kinds of bliss in a sustainable way.
There is a segment where you do touch upon LSD. Where does LSD come into all this?
Yeah. So, I mean, naively, a lot of people think of psychedelics. LSD being kind of the archetypical example of it, as not having much value at all. I mean, they kind of like trigger new experiences, but people tend to think of them as just hallucinatory or devoid of value. But all of the research shows that actually done in proper settings, you can actually have a lot of breakthroughs, both personal, emotional, but also in terms of information processing. I mean, there's like these studies in the 60s conducted by James Fadiman and Harman, that they were taking researchers who've been struggling with very difficult technical problems for 3 months or more. And on a single session of mescaline or LSD, they were able to solve the problem. Of course, this is with a lot of preparation, a lot of intention setting, people who are like really determined and really want to actually solve the problem. And in those circumstances, the state can be very beneficial to try out entirely new possibilities. And that's kind of, if you're already hyper-motivated and you actually want to solve a problem, I think those states of consciousness can be very beneficial, even just at the information processing level, like not even just in terms of making you feel better or more motivated, just in terms of providing new information processing tools.
It seems like all this talk, you know, about making the human condition better, especially in the transhumanist spirit, I always had this criticism that some of the people who, you know, practice transhumanism comes from kind of from, you know, we see today that there's this kind of decadence nihilism happening where people, you know, we have average people who could be benefiting society and civilization, but rather they're just asleep and they just go about their work and go home and then maybe have a family and kids and that's the only thing they contribute. But then they tell their kids to be the same thing, free for all, downward nihilism. I was just wondering how could transhumanism overcome that nihilism and decadence?
Yeah, for sure. There is this very wonderful quote by David Pierce that he says, take care of happiness and the meaning of life will take care of itself. So I do tend to have the notion that actually a lot of nihilism and feelings that everything is decadent or feelings that things are not going anywhere have a lot more to do with hedonic tone and valence. I mean, basically how good or bad you feel on a day-to-day basis, then it has to do with actually whether we have a good philosophy or not. I mean, of course, having a good philosophy is really important. A philosophy that's convincing, persuasive, it enriches one's conception of the world. But without a positive feeling, all of that doesn't do anything. That's kind of like where I see that as we start to develop these technologies of bliss, a lot of these concerns will actually just fall away. I mean, people will try out these ways of experiencing bliss, experiencing universal love, experiencing kind of hyper-motivation and so on. And the question of whether what we're doing has meaning or not will just simply not arise. It will just be self-evident that our states of consciousness and what we're doing is, in a sense, intrinsically meaningful.
So you do touch upon issues of world peace. So you kind of tie the two issues together. So would you say that a lot of problems like involving conflicts from crime to political conflicts are the root, would you say the root problems are psychological with these issues of anger, anxiety, depression?
Yes, I would say that's probably the bulk of it. I mean, there is another problem, which actually is a little bit deeper. I mean, I think like solving, let me take a step back. I think like creating states of consciousness that are extremely blissful is only part of the equation. The other part of the equation is going to be produce states of consciousness that also allows us to have a different ontology of the world. So what do I mean by that? It's very common for people on psychedelics, as well as people who delve very deeply into spirituality, to have a kind of like an experience where their sense of self gets transformed. They stop thinking of themselves as kind of just this entity that starts to exist when they're born and stops existing when they die. And they think of themselves as something much more expansive, as kind of the effects of their actions, or even in the more extreme case, they think of themselves as consciousness itself or something like that. I mean, there is a sense in which this is delusional, but there's also a sense in which this is pretty true. And I think that if we can also kind of recruit the states of consciousness that allows us to conceive of ourselves as something much bigger than how we usually think of ourselves, then also cooperation between nations and cooperation between people who might be very hostile to each other will be facilitated a lot. I mean, it's kind of to give you an example, if you think that who you are is just who you are today, and that when you go to sleep, you will die in a sense, and whoever wakes up in your body tomorrow will be a different entity, you will be not at all motivated into taking care of yourself, or you will be not motivated into kind of like leaving any resources or money for the person who's going to inhabit your body tomorrow because you think of that person as a different entity. I think like with many of these extraordinarily bizarre states of consciousness that we will understand scientifically in the future, something like that might happen, but in a much more expansive way, that you will think of yourself not only as well belonging to your body or belonging to your nation, but you will think of everybody in the world as kind of belonging to this expanded sense of self. And if you know that other people in the other countries also have reconceptualized their self in that way, even if you're kind of like really selfish, you will still be motivated to actually help them out and cooperate with the others, precisely because you will both think of each other as part of a grander self. So I think like I would say it's a combination of states of consciousness that have like much more bliss, and where we are like not afraid of suffering, we're not afraid of being hurt, together with states of consciousness that provide an expanded sense of self. And I think that's kind of like where I was going at with the Peaceful Quelea article, that once we combine those two things together, then I think like a formula for world peace might actually be reachable.
Do you see a lot of this as accessible to everyone, or could it become sort of more of a luxury item?
I mean, I'm hoping it will be universally accessible. I mean, under kind of the same premise, if you identify with consciousness in general, you will want to help every sentient being have access to this understanding and these wonderful states of consciousness. So, I mean, my sincere hope is that everybody will have access to it. It's also worth noting that most likely it will be a sort of information technology. And pretty much every information technology that we know of has this property that over time its cost tends to zero, because we find ways of automating its production, and then we find ways of automating the automation process as well. It's not like the substrate of bliss, or like the biomolecular requirements of bliss is some sort of like scarce resource. It's something much more of a configuration. So if you know how to instantiate that configuration, you don't really have to fight for it. I mean, you just can freely distribute it. It's not a zero-sum game.
Do you have an estimate of the time frame when this will be available to the public?
Oh, gosh. Well, it definitely depends on how optimistic I am about things such as like how successful our research is. It also has to do a lot with basically how difficult or complex states of bliss turn out to be. I mean, our primary hypothesis is that bliss is actually an extraordinarily simple state. So, and it has to do with symmetry and harmony. And we have like a few proposed equations for how to actually measure it. If this actually pans out and it's true that bliss is actually an extraordinarily simple state, then we're talking about something like decades, maybe 20 years or 30 years to have some sort of technology that maybe it doesn't deliver everything that I'm saying, but it's something that maybe you can put on and it might produce a reliable MDMA-like state of consciousness that is non-addictive and you also don't get dependent to it and it's not neurotoxic. And I think like something like that might introduce a lot of opportunity for kind of like getting the process starting much more at an exponential rate. So yeah, my guess is that if we are lucky, we're talking about like a 20, 30 year time frame. If the truth is a lot more complicated, then yeah, I don't know, possibly 300 years. It's hard to tell.
It seems that a lot of people, especially in kind of the Democratic or liberal parties, flirt with transhumanism. Though it's interesting because we could be talking about conservatives who want to conserve the current nature of how people live versus people you might hear about, you know, liberals trying to say that people got to make progress, and whether that progress entails having people of color, people of the future, there seems to be overlaps between transhumanism and liberalism. Do you think that in a transhumanism system, there would still be left-wing, right-wing politics, or would transhumanism fulfill the need of all politics and then it pretty much becomes something of the past?
That's a wonderful question. Actually, I haven't given it much thought. It's a really clever question. What will be the end date for politics? Well, I would say that my guess is that as soon as we invent mind-melding technology, basically some sort of technology that allows us to connect our brains directly to each other and become a unified entity, maybe temporarily, and then be able to disconnect. That might be the end of politics, because as soon as we have that kind of technology, the other people's opinions will not be at all a mystery. I mean, you will be able to connect with them, temporarily merge with them, and then figure out why is it that they have different opinions that you can't really relate to. Actually, what is informing those opinions? And my guess is that we will be extremely understanding of each other, and we will be like a lot faster at actually arriving at a consensus. Before that, it might be potentially that with super happiness technology, we will all basically find something to agree upon, which is, yes, we should all have access to broad spectrum super happiness. And to that extent, any disagreement might be very minor. Now, there is the possibility, though, that depending on how the technology is introduced, that we might at first introduce technology that basically may create states of bliss that are incommensurable with each other. So that you could have a technology that produces a state of happiness that also creates cravings for a particular kind of worldview or a particular kind of situation. And a different kind of technology that is also blissful, but it creates cravings for something different. And that these two things are not easy to relate to each other. That maybe
you
need.
You're saying there could be a technology that creates a need for bliss coming out of something that's harmful.
Yeah, definitely. That could be. I mean, that's why I'm pretty emphatic about combining bliss with an enhanced, expanded understanding of oneself and theory of personal identity. Because, I mean, truth be told, one can be very sadistic and also very blissful if one is not actually representing the pain that one is creating. So definitely bliss itself is not really enough. One also needs this enhanced theory of personal identity. You could, for example, imagine some very belligerent country using bliss technology to wirehead soldiers that will be completely happy to die for their country because they can't anticipate the pain that they might experience, or they can't anticipate the problem that death might entail because they're completely hyper-motivated to accomplish whatever the state wants them to do. So, I mean, that's a very unfortunate possibility and definitely a danger to be in the lookout for.
One scenario is that, do you think corporations could engineer this to get consumers to get bliss out of people buying their products?
Yeah, definitely. And also corporations getting their own employees completely hooked on their own company so that they will never be tempted to leave. Yes, all of those are like very serious and important possibilities to consider. Again, one of the reasons why I think it's really important to be able to also develop... Oh, actually, I haven't talked about this, but one of the areas that I also explore is basically anti-mind control technology. I mean, basically, if you kind of like with the ideology of you being in charge of your own bliss and not allowing any external entities to basically set the rules for when you are able or not to be blissful. I think that's really important. Definitely should be kind of in one of the core ideals of any transhumanist movement is kind of the freedom to set your own bliss parameters. Might be really important to prevent these scenarios.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, Andres, is there anything else you'd like to add for our audience?
Again, thank you very much for having me. I think if you're interested at all in any of these, we're definitely ramping up our Quilia Research Institute activities. We're probably going to be applying more heavily for funding within the next 6 months. And if anybody's interested in getting involved, definitely reach out. That would be my my final comment.
Andres Gomez Emelson, it's been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Of course. Thank you very much for having me.
And also, thanks, Francis Nelly.
It's nice talking to you guys, like always.
Thank you, guys.